made possible and probably necessary by all the work that the high school and junior high school kids did this semester or quarter. Anyway, we'd like to open that to the rest of the community to read after they've done their readings. But Sonia Sharp and I have been teaching creative writing this last quarter to Johanna, Natalie, Serena, and Janet Moore. And they've just been doing such great work. And what they're reading tonight is just a small part of all the work that they've done. They've written and rewritten things over and over again. The lots of exercises. And we were just so impressed because, you know, we would give stories and materials and exercises that we did in college, and they just took it no problem. So I hope you enjoyed the reading, and with that, I'll turn it over to Serena.
Okay, first thing I'm going to read is a story that I actually wrote last semester, and it's called Doctor's Office. Sitting up straight, Dashna squirmed in her seat, trying to find that comfortable position that always seemed to elude her. She hated the high-pitched whine the impersonal plastic seats made as she moved. Somehow it grated on her and got under already frazzled nerves. Settling down into yet another position that, like all the rest, would prove uncomfortable within 10 minutes, Dasha gazed down at her daughter. Dina was fully involved with the cheap little McDonald's toys that had been donated by some caring soul that wanted to dispense to their kids' junk. Dina loved it, though, and the simple wheel-around toys entranced her so completely that she had, for the time being, forgotten about the earache that the last couple of months had plagued her and caused these now routine visits to the doctor. Dasha didn't know a thing about illnesses and medical cures, but she did know that she didn't want the tubes, these crisp, clean, don't-touch-anything-you-might-infect-it American doctors wanted to put in her little darling's ears. Plastic and metal and chemicals were their solution to everything in this distanced world. Yes, that was the world word for this place. Back home in Africa, she had thought of the United States as this far-off wonderland that would be a paradise for a widowed mother with a baby girl. The U.S., with its amazing social security and idealistic picture of a warm meal, bed, and a home for everyone. But now that she was here, she was as far away as ever. Distance, she thought again, as she swung her glance over the other occupants of the seats. Eyes darted here and there, never resting, and always looking at anything but the faces of their neighbors. Some would stare blindly into space, and others would fake at sleeping. One young man, a green mohawk adorning his head, glared angrily back at her for not obeying the unspoken rules of the room. His thoughts being like the bright billboards that littered the sides of the busy streets. What are you looking at? Don't you accuse me of nothing, and I won't accuse you. She stared back for a minute, wondering at his anger, and then turned back into herself. Light tones of polite talk hummed dimly, and behind empty words, the young man's thoughts found others of his kind. Sighing, Dasha stood and twisted her way through the crowded maze of legs that all quickly jerked back, avoiding contact so as to maintain their own solitary vigils. The back of her head felt needled by the intense stares of the waiting patients. Like trapped animals, they glared at this foreign lady with her bright clothes, who was braver than they, who sat docilely in their seats. The strange lady who ignored the rules of the room and now dared to question the secretary. A sad smile twitched on Dashna's face, but was quickly hidden again as she reached the high countertop. "When is my appointment again?" Dashna asked, the tiny thing hidden down deep behind the pastel barrier that blocked her from the bleak sight of the waiting room. Startled eyes shot up and peered short-sightedly at this unexpected intruder. Quickly signing off a half-completed solitaire game, the lady snatched up a clipboard and flipped through it, clacking her teeth importantly. "We're overbooked today. It'll be at least another half an hour." "I've already been here. It'll be at least another half an hour," the lady snipped, swiveling her chair around and turning her attention back to her computer. Propping her elbows down on the counter, Dashna leaned her head on her hand. Turning, she stared unseeingly at the little calendar perched in the corner. Lost in her thoughts, she stared, and slowly the picture came into focus. A small gray kitten was curled up in a flower pot, the original occupants spewing out from under the small ball in an array of purples and pinks. Below the small image, a saying was written, "God's given every day especially for you. Take advantage of it." She smiled at the cute kitten and rolled her eyes at the saying. If God had given her today, she would have said no thank you and walked back happily to the yesterday when her daughter hadn't felt the telling pinch in her ear. Turning, she walked back to her seat. The wary looks that had plagued her first junior were now replaced with faces of triumph and "I told you so." Flinching at the squeak, she sat back down in her plastic chair. How she wished at times like this to be back in her homey village. There the medical office, just an ordinary hut really, was crowded and filled with talk and even laughter as folks shared gossip with their, while their children were away. The medicine woman, Minka, was close friends with everyone, it was seen, and her lively spirit would fill the room so that even the nervous young ones could not hold back their smiles tugging their lips. The medicines were more personal, too. Minka would tell someone to use this plant or that one and describe how to mix it properly or even do it herself. Here in this plastic-wrapped America, Dashna couldn't see anything in Minka's cures in the white bottles lying in the plastic stores. Mommy, that boy took my truck. Dina tugged at Dashna's bright skirts, looking urgently over her shoulder at the little blonde boy whose bright blue eyes were round as saucers. The stolen truck dangled loosely in his grip, and an anxious thumb was lost in his small mouth. Hey, honey. Maybe he'd be playing, wanting to play with it. Can you see another toy you want to play with? I want to go home. I know, sweetheart. It'll be just a little longer. Then that dog will come out and scare that hurt right away from your ear. Why don't you read a book till then? Maybe that little boy likes trucks. Maybe he wants to read with me. Go and see. Grabbing a little book with a red fire engine on the cover, Dina marched over to the little boy. With a small nod and an increased fever at his thumb, the boy plopped down beside her daughter, and they both leaned over the bright pictures. Watching them, Dashna was reminded of herself years ago. Her mother had always told her stories about how Dashna had been such an outgoing and social child. Don't you let anyone ever make you feel that it ain't your place to be who you are, her mother had often repeated. Dashna's home had always been a place where everyone had been encouraged to be themselves, no matter the circumstances. And through the years, Dashna had lost none of her confident personality. Even in this foreign country in which she now lived, Dashna would simply repeat her mother's words to herself whenever she felt intimidated or inferior by people or her surroundings. She had lived in this country for almost 8 years now, and more she noticed the odd looks that were directed towards such a confident and self-assured foreigner. She simply held her head higher and continued about her life. When she had first arrived, she had known hardly any English and struggled for a year before finding a good program to learn. Once she had found it, though, she poured her time and energy into becoming fluent. She refused to be hindered by the language barrier, and with the help of the class, now spoke English as comfortably as if she'd been raised on it like Dina was. The door to the waiting room slammed, and a man with long, sad face took a seat across from her. Scrimming around in her seat, Dashna peered back at the flower-encircled clock behind her. Another half an hour wasted in this stuffy room. Setting her mouth in a tight, angry line, she stood and began the journey back to the counter with determined steps. The blonde, puffy-haired secretary popped up and, seeing her tormentor returning for another bout, grabbed for a clipboard. Quickly flipping through it, she stood up and with much flourish read, "Dashna Bilianta, you can be seen now." Looking around importantly, as if she didn't know who belonged to that name, her glance finally landed on Dashna. "Right through those doors, ma'am." With a fling of her hair and a look of relief, the secretary returned to her cave. Half smiling to herself, Dashna called over her daughter, and with a straight, proud back, she marched to the doors, leaving the cold, lonely room and jealous eyes behind her. Okay. Poem that we did this year, or this last semester. It's called On the Hill. I sat on the old stump, shivering. What was taking them so long? The snow began to seep through my snow pants. A lonely bird fluttered above me as I prepared another snowball and added it to the growing pyramid beside me. Muffled yells drifted down the hill. I leaned forward eagerly to peer up past the hazy corner, but saw nothing besides the drooping trees. Carefully, I picked ice crystals from my woolly mittens and stuffed up my frozen hair. My proud little pile really didn't seem worth the effort anymore. I sprawled like a pop-up toy, half-formed snow figure abandoned, as laughter and screams of protest sailed down the lonesome path. I grabbed a hurriedly shaped missile and grinned. The sled swooped down and around. My cousin turned and taunted my sister's slow vehicle. The snowball caught him smack in the back of the head. We laughed at his bewildered look as he streaked on down the hill, and my sister steered into the bank to watch. We didn't envy him the long climb. I pushed her down just for good measure. She threw snow on my face. We grabbed the sled and trudged back up.
I'm going to read a poem that called My Feet Have Known. It was an assignment to start with that. My feet have known mold socks and itchy grass, They have known cold iron sheets and warm rugs. My feet have remembered the feel of warm mud through little toes, and also the dread of Sunday's stiff black shoes. My feet have followed dusty trails around mountains and avoided cracks in city streets. My feet have known the feel of kicking through cool water and have felt wet Hawaiian sand. My feet have slipped out of bed at night and padded down the hall. They have run in flip-flops and tripped over unsuspecting logs. My feet have been tickled and played with when they were small, and I've hid from scary-looking toenail clippers ready to attack. My feet have pushed the bike wheels around the first wobbly way and have danced until they were blistered and stood bare in the snow. My feet have been caked with dirt and have been decorated with scarlet nail polish and rings. They have tiptoed around sharp rocks and avoided annoying encounters. My feet have stepped on venomous slugs and met with large insects. They have known prickly leaves, wet rocks, cut grass, and warm porches. My feet have wandered around aimlessly, sat around lazily, tapped impatiently, and walked away. These two poems are on pictures that we got, and what they're about in the story. Waves. My father and I run into the waves. I was frightened of the monster waves. Foamy at the mouth, he let go. Panicking, I struggled. Looking up, I could see the waves reflecting the sunlight, like a camera lens. The hand suddenly shoots from the water, pulling. I grab on, hoping it will pull me out. The water splashes behind me. I take a deep breath of air. For a second, I can focus on my hero, my sister. She grabs me and runs onto the warm beach as a new wave approaches. I try to develop in my mind what just happened. Before it comes clear, my mother pulls me back into the waves. The other one is hidden in costumes. My family stands in front of our house. He's dressed up in weird fashions. I stand next to my mother. I thought of a costume last second. I stop and pose hand over hand, trying to figure out what my attitude is. My mom stands close to me in a gaudy golden shirt and black pants. Her hair is tightly curled and her lipstick an intense red. My sister is trying to be serious while holding down a laugh. Her outfit is a uniform for Scott Olsen's Academy for Girls. Her skirt is made of a yard blanket and duct tape. My father is in the back, looks weird to most people in his bright multicolored clothing, but to our family, he looks absolutely normal. Waiting, there we all stand, caught in the moment, waiting for the bus to school. This time I'm gonna read a story, and the assignment was to write a short story off of a list of first sentences. So it's called Underwear. Randolph Burbage made his first deal with the devil on a bright, unseasonably warm December afternoon in 1997. Her name was Lisa Spinnett. She was a snotty, red-haired ringleader of the second grade. He hated her. Her unreasonably green eyes mocked him and made his stomach turn with dread. Lisa was the kind of person that giggled over her pickle sandwich as you gnawed on a rubbery green apple resembling something like your dog's old chew toy. Lisa was the kind of person you would slither into a nearby storage closet to avoid. Randolph kicked a pile of slush, then groaned painfully as the cold seeped through his now muddy sneakers. Randolph, Burbage, had made a deal with the devil. Randolph had been sitting in the library when he saw her coming. He grabbed the biggest book he could reach, Modern Biology, 4th edition, and pulled it clumsily over his eyes. Her voice came first, high and shrill, like his mother's in the morning. Randolph, Burbage! He lowered the book reluctantly. He had been caught. He looked at her shoes. They were red, as they had always been. The shoes started tapping, and he looked up, very slowly. Randolph could tell, even before he saw her face, she was furious. Was it or wasn't it you that put that thing in my desk this afternoon? She said thing in a way that made it sound slimy and disgusting before you even knew what it was. He stared stupidly. Well? This time it was Isabella, her best friend and sidekick. She stood behind Lisa, mousy pigtails swinging in disapproval. He gobbled like a turkey for a minute under the intimidating glare. Then it clicked. He remembered seeing Buster Keaton, the class bully, snicker as he plopped a ridiculously fat gray-brown toad in Lisa's desk during lunch break. Nope, it wasn't me. Pinky promised. You can even ask Tommy. We were looking at Batman comics that he got, and we saw someone do it. You could hang me on the clothesline between your house and your mama's pink panties, but I wouldn't ever tell you who it was. He took a deep breath, crossed his arms decisively, pivoted around, bent over, picked up his backpack, and stalked away. Oh, Randall! This, she actually sang. There was no way this could be good news. Speaking of panties, Randall's heart stopped. His gut turned inside out and his tongue got stuck down the back of his throat. If you don't tell me who did it, I'll just have to tell the whole class that you have Care Bear underpants. He gasped. She must have seen them when he bent over to get his backpack. They were the ones that his mom made him wear because he was late for school and all the others were in the wash. Oh no, what if the whole class found out? Then pretty soon the whole school would know. Then they'd go home and tell their friends, and then the whole city would know. And then all of them would go tell their friends, and pretty soon the whole state would know, and then the whole country would find out, and pretty soon the whole world would know that Randolph Bruidge had Care Bear underpants. Oh, he didn't think he could stand it. Randolph had thought Buster's joke was pretty entertaining at the time, but now the mere thought of the situation made him woozy. This was more than a 7-year-old could handle. Buster was the biggest kid around, including the 3rd and 4th grades. Buster was one of the boys that fried ants with a magnifying glass at recess. Buster was not someone to mess around with. If he were to tell Lisa that Buster had put the toad in the desk, he was surrendering his life to the mercy of Buster Keaton. But Randolph had no choice. He took a deep breath and prepared himself for what he was about to do. It was Buster. Ooh, I knew it. That slob is always making nasty jokes. When I get my hands on him. She made a motion with her hands that Randolph's mother would have shrieked at. Suddenly, Isabella started jumping up and down like a pogo stick and began whispering rapidly into Lisa's ear. With every word, Lisa got a more mischievous look. Randolph groaned. Tell me, Randolph. I'm sure you wouldn't mind helping us play a little trick on our friend Buster, now would you? Her voice was so sweet it made him sick. He gulped. Because we thought you could help us get him back for what he did today with the toad. And since you're pretty much at our mercy at the moment, can't really say no now, can you? This scene played over and over in Randall's head as he trudged home through the sloppy streets. He thought about it on his way up the faded brick steps. Thought about it as he walked through the leaden door. Thought about it as he crossed the kitchen floor. Thought about it all the way up the 16 steps to his room. There he collapsed on his bed and stared at a spider on the ceiling. Then, just for good measure, he thought about it some more. Suddenly, without warning, he sat up straight in his bed, peeled off his corduroy pants, removed his underwear, replaced them with the clean ones from his dresser, put back his pants back on. He marched deliberately to the garbage can. Care Bear underpants pinched tightly between his thumb and index finger, then plopped them ceremoniously into the garbage. About 10 minutes later, he came back with his mother's scissors and shredded them into the waste paper basket. Satisfied, he put his hands on his hips and paraded down the stairs to the kitchen. It's not done, but that's all I have. On a sentence, I have gained and also won. I have lost. I have gained and I have lost. The friends from before, new friends in a new place. Their laughter, our laughter, and joys. New memories, new jokes, new life. Dreams, shared dreams, taken away. New dreams to think of, and others to come. The flicker of light bouncing ahead, almost there, gone.
tears flowing. New spirits sweep them away. I see them running, laughing, in a world. New races of friends in a world I am now in. Will I ever see their smiles and laughter again? New smiles of laughter come, but someday they will have to fade. I will remember, but do they? I will always remember. Will these new spirits of friends have the same memory? Do they know where I've been? I will remember these friends, old and new, just as before. The name of the one is on childhood memory. Runaway. I'm a runaway. I am a runaway. I'll go to the top of the mountain. I'll go to the top of the playhouse. I have food in a bag tied to a stick. I've got cookies and juice in my blanket tied to a wooden pole. I'm wearing my straw hat and patched overalls. I'm wearing my red dress and red leggings. I don't need my shoes. My feet are strong. My shoes are black foam and blue sandal strap. My parents won't miss me. I'll be back for dinner. The wind ruffles my loose, rough hair. The dusty wind messes up my pigtails. I'm too strong for those tornadoes ahead. Those dust devils will get some dust in my eyes. I'll wade the river and it'll go up to my chin. It'll be an easy jump over that puddle. I imagine I'm in a different life. I am true to myself. I am a runaway. I am a runaway. I have a story from Janet Ward that I asked her if she would let me read it this evening, and she said yes. And it's a story written from the perspective of the house, or of the castle, in The Princess and the Pea fairy tale. So, it's just a little introduction. It's called The Princess's Pea. Deep in my innermost corridor lies the precious green orb that caused so much in our kingdom to change. On the day after this marvelous event, the castle told the bakery, who told the shoe shop, who told me the strange happenings that went on the night before. The shoe shop told me that the castle had been working hard, just like all of us old buildings, to fight the storms that had suddenly blown in. The castle, who was quite snotty in my opinion, said that someone had knocked violently on her door. She focused on the big figure and saw that it was a wet, dirty beggar in a brown cloak that shaded its face. The castle had been fairly irritated at having to lose her concentration on the storm in order to focus on this poor beggar who had the nerve to pound on her like she was a drum. Still, she said, she had been curious as to what this person could want. When her master, the king, had come to open the door, the cloaked figure had removed its hood, and the castle was amazed to see a gorgeous woman instead of an old beggar. Obviously, so was the king, because he took her inside and showed her to the living quarters where a fire was blazing. Now, because we buildings don't understand a word our masters say, the castle had guessed what the conversation had been. According to her, the girl was a princess, but it didn't take a rocket scientist to figure that one out. Not only was she fair, she carried herself in a royal way. The king called his son, who was a spoiled brat, to see if he wanted to marry the girl. He obviously wanted to, because his pimpled face lit up into a smile so big that his beady eyes disappeared. When the queen came down to see what everything was about, she slapped her son on the head and sent him up to his room. She then began her role of the bad cop, because the castle had seen her bombarding question after question on the poor girl, who just sat there calm as a lily and answered every one of them. The good cop, the king, finally interfered and told the queen that she needed to lay off. The queen apparently didn't believe that the girl was a princess. Normally, the king only gets his way by promising the queen some kind of jewel, but that night he only talked to the queen, and that convinced her to let the girl at least stay the night. The queen had helped prepare a guest room for the girl, and she fixed the bed herself. Then, the castle said, a huge gust of wind had come, causing her to focus on resisting its pull. When she finally looked back at the queen, 20 mattresses had been placed on the bed. That night, when the girl fell asleep, she had tossed and turned endlessly. The next morning, the girl had gone down to breakfast, looking extremely worn out. The pimply prince was not was not too pleased by this and expressed so by eating as loud as a hog. The queen, though, was delighted and gave her son to the girl in marriage. She placed a single pea under those 20 mattresses, and the girl had still felt it. To the queen, this only meant one thing, that she was a princess indeed. So after the wedding, the pea was placed in a glass box inside my quarters, where it stays to this day, the end. So at this point, anybody else who wants to read is welcome to do so.
Cream, so now you get the coffee. We did a 10-minute write when Morgan Carlson was here, and this one was called Stairway. So I took the letters of the word and made a stairway out of them. So in the first line, it starts with S. You know, the first word is stair. And in the second line, the second word starts with a T. So if you see, so then the third line, the third word starts with A. So it forms like a visual stairway. Okay. Got 10 minutes. Most of my time thinking about that. But it's kind of a stairway within a stairway. Stairs went down from a door in the kitchen to the basement. One time, my brother fell down the entire stairway. He tested ambidextrous, but the counselor said it could be from a blow to his head. He took the interview because he was up for promotion in the Air Force. If he passed, his rank would advance. Evidently, he was viewed as worthy. He received his promotion to captain after an appropriate amount of waiting on the list. He eventually became colonel with 26 years of service.
Oh, no, there's more. I just wanted to know if that was the stairway part.
The question remains, did the fall down the stairway help or hinder his career? Or perhaps the years following and his many climbs up the stairway made a significant contribution to his life. He now lives in a house with a stairway by the kitchen.
Is anybody opposed to me spouting some anti-president or Bush administration poetry? If anybody would be offended, I would definitely not. I have other stuff I could do. This is like a slam piece that I did in D.C. Before we invaded Iraq. And it's a response to, kind of a response to 9/11. Time to note the politics, the reverend of this capitalistic corporate clique, him who all these altar boys of voted legislation praise, him the demon, the demigod of a large demise, the beady eyes lost in an oil drilling haze. Are we not those who remember the surrender of their own cries? Have we all been dismissed to die? Him, yes, someone to blame, and should it be my aim? On target, I'm shooting for the thought that's farthest and largest in the Washington, D.C. mainframe. For the back end of our united PC monoculture saturated confusion is a constant shame. Their wires tapped by their own paranoid retreat from social welfare into delusion, the grand contusion, an all-out American aneurysm looking for the question to the fading solution, a mystical secular schism. Who do we believe? What historical evidence do we retrieve as the ancient Indian wool-woven symbol of the man lost in the maze has been achieved? And should we follow his next step, his trap, his wet noodle thought provoking the boiling pot of common ancestors in faraway lands, desert-dwelling women and children with rocky hands, sand dunes and castles of anti-American clans, all of us separated from all of them, those who are our lineage, once family, now foe, forwarded into a time when all can't be mended. So long to the, all those days we pretended they did not exist, cease to persist, our won't be kissed, their God, their rain, just the vague mist, unknown, we can't see their pain, their indwelling, our typical madness insane. And will they triumph in the least? In their own eyes, yes, I truly believe they will try to end the beginnings of our social disease, our ineffectual, uncaring, painless drink of their breath of fresh air each morning, the way we indifferently think, sojourning in our glorified, glamorized, Hollywood cutout, H-E-R, O-I-N-E daydream, our patriotic theme. Yes, we can believe in ourselves some more, antagonized by last year, today, sometime, before or after now, when we all woke up to the media speed coverage of our own yawns in disbelief, social anthrax screams and bio unlogical, how could it happen to us in this way? Worrisome seams now ripping apart a continental dividend and profit margin we were too sure was in the bank. But was it all of us, each you and I? Did we together perpetrate the faith, the homelands, and religious monumental keepsakes? What have we done, those of us in this room? What role played us out to be its nemesis? What is the genesis of this tomb? Now gathering souls, breaking down hopes and instigating fears for the past years. We just want peace, a piece or two, a few child lighthearted chances to explore this life beyond our eyes and ears. In each and every you or him or her, causally dependent, connected in this sacred dance on earth. Most of us just want a chance to fight the reasons enemies exist, hatred persists, where the majority of humankind's eternal soul is educated less and less as it grows through the billions. And most of all, we want to determine what love truly is. We have accomplished many wonders, but asundered a blunder, mothered intelligence and fathered thunder in the heart and hope of the average bill collector. It's time to kill the late payment stress infector. You and I, the internationally empathic leaves of this tree of humanity, fallen prey to insanities developed by a kaleidoscope of vanities, under a nation of freed will and money-generated media-created false senses of security. Nothing left for us but a maturity, a profound maternity directed toward each action we take, each socio-economically planned movement we make, especially militarily. Verily, verily, with a new vision of integrity, elections of leaders with eyes of sincerity, it is our job, our living mob mentality, to recognize this need for revolutionary hilarity, conviviality, revive the lost sense of commonality, community, worldly family. We are the last stage, quite possibly the last stage in the epic existences and instances of harmonization, creation's primal infatuation with transconsciousness homilies. To be forever heard in the cosmic halls of sentient fame, have we remembered yet the last time we live this life again?
Usually I was shopping it.
How did you get it all memorized? It's impressive.
That's what you gotta do for people to believe you.
Listening to Christmas music and February ending. Outside, icicles quietly drip into the snow, like hands divesting themselves ring by ring. The light warms half my face, and silent night reminds me that arrival carries ending in its arms. I would wait. I would wish the snow melt slowly. I would want the warmth of my breath to drape the cold of morning still,
I would always know that spring is coming. Is there anybody else?
Getting up. Shifting in my chair.
Okay. Thank you guys for coming.
Thank you.